Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thanks for subscribing, downloading, rating, sticking with us, because the world of AI is ever catching closer. One day we could all just be listening to AI podcasts, couldn't we? Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be talking about what happens in the very first days after the Big Bang. And I'm not talking about the Big Bang, I'm talking about implantation of an egg in the womb. Because this is kind of like just after the Big Bang, this really interesting period where lots of stuff happens and a reason why so many embryos fail, but we hardly ever get to see it because it's so quick. We're going to be talking about that and speaking to researchers from Cambridge who have actually recreated artificial womb lining in a lab to be able to see exactly what's going on. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of the comments at the end of the pod. First, though, it's time to look back at the more interesting stories from the world of science. This week, we're joined by Dr. Susan Kelleher from the School of Chemical Sciences at DCU and the ever Dr. Shane Bergen, physicist at UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Susan, has to do with asthma.
Yes, this is about work that looks at the underlying cause of asthma. And I think this is really interesting because it's one of these things where you think, surely we know that. Don't we have asthma? We've got that wrapped up, right? Didn't we figure all that out? And so what this is looking at a different type of molecule that they found really prevalently in people who have asthma. So the molecule that is thought to cause asthma is called leukotriene, and it causes inflammation and all of the symptoms that we know that comes with asthma. But this work from Case Western Reserve University in Ohio and published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology suggests that maybe the targeting of these leukotrienes is wrong, and there are new culprits that they think might be actually the cause of it. And these new molecules are called pseudoleukotrienes. So they act very similarly, not surprisingly, and they're very chemically similar to the leukotrienes. However,
and just as, because you're a chemist, right?
Yes.
What does that mean? When people say, oh, they're very similar, do they mean that like they have the same component elements, or do they mean like they have the same shape, or they have same like bits, like, you know, an alcohol is COOH, so they might have, what do they mean by that?
So I think actually it's probably all of the above in terms of if things are made of the same atoms, they often have the same shape, if they have the same type of structure. So they act similarly in the same kind of receptors, and so they're doing the same job. So there's the same type of key for the same kind of lock. But the problem is they are made in a different way. So the pseudoleukotrienes are made with what are called free radicals. And free radical.
Cool, man.
Yes, very cool. There was a band, I recall, in the early 2000s also with a great name. And the fact that they're made by this free radical mechanism rather than the standard enzymatic pathway means that there are lots of these free radicals around. And free radicals are super reactive. And then when those pseudoleukotrienes are around, they cause lots of issues in the surrounding tissue because there's lots of these free radicals around. So the method by which they're made in the body actually causes, they think, the inflammation.
And the so it's not actually the molecule itself. It's how they're made.
Exactly.
And so okay.
The path by which they were made, and then the sort of the free radical nature of the mechanism by the way they were produced.
Does that make trying to cure asthma easier? If they're right?
They're very reactive, so that's great. They were found at higher levels in patients with asthma. So they are significantly higher levels of them in patients with asthma than people without asthma. And so they kind of reckoned that this is one of the triggers. But
and you say reactive, does that mean that if you try and target them, they're gonna latch onto stuff?
I suppose the mechanism from a chemist's point of view, the free radical nature of them means that they could be somewhere where you could do some nice chemistry, but you have to try and make that more interesting for the molecule rather than the damage pathway that, you know, rather than causing further inflammation, you really have to distract it with another molecule that says, don't go over there to that tissue and inflame it, come over here and react with me instead. So they are reactive, but to target these, you'd have to come up with a sort of a distraction method, I suppose, for them.
I like that. Our second story, Shane, has to do with dark oxygen. Are we not sick of overusing this term dark for meaning not real?
Yeah, the chemists basically were trying to get in on the physicists' action with dark matter and dark energy, I think. But really what they mean here is oxygen that's produced in the dark. So at the bottom of the ocean.
So they gave it a cool name, but it's just oxygen that's...
Yeah.
Comes from somewhere deep.
But what's cool about this is that when we reported it on the show in 2024, we reported on the discovery of it 4,000 metres below the surface of the sea in the Pacific Ocean. But there was no sense as to what may have caused it, because whilst there is 20% or is it 20 or 21% oxygen in our atmosphere, oxygen's very reactive. So it's only there because of photosynthesis. So we have a continuous supply of it, where light splits open carbon dioxide molecules and releases oxygen as a result. Mm. Carbon goes into growing the plant itself.
Yeah.
So there's no light at the bottom of the ocean. So what's driving it? The other way of making oxygen is to do splitting of water. So you take H2O and you split it into its constituent hydrogen and oxygen. But that takes an awful lot of electricity to do that. You have to have a voltage. You have to have a potential difference that will drive that reaction. What they are saying in this study, it's kind of more of a sum up, is it's a new mission. The same scientists are sending a submersible down to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. In this, it's called Nautilus, which is pretty cool. And it's in the Clarion Clipper Zone between Hawaii and Mexico. And it's going down there to look at the surface of the ocean. Originally, this was funded because of interest.
Not the surface, the depth.
The floor. The floor. Thank you. Yeah. They know that there are polymetallic nodules down there on the bottom of the sea, right? And they're made out of metals like manganese and cobalt. Now, they may be acting as catalysts, which is able to speed up the splitting reaction. So they're going down, they're going to literally try and measure the potential difference across the nodule to see if there would be a sufficient gradient there to split the water. Alternatively, it might be that microbes are present, which would be unusual given the depth.
Yeah.
And microbes might be evolving oxygen because of their biochemical reactions. So we don't know. Mm. This is a new adventure.
Yeah.
And we hope to get results back. It's very controversial.
They might find dinosaurs down there at 20,000 leagues. Our third story, Susan, has to do with the menopause.
Yeah, and it's an incredible study. So it comes from the University of Cambridge, and they studied 125,000 women, information from the UK Biobank, where they looked at brain scans, mental health measures, sleep patterns and cognitive tests between women who are premenopausal, postmenopausal without the HRT, hormone replacement therapy, and postmenopausal without it. And they found that there is a significant reduction in grey matter in women who have gone through the menopause. And grey matter, as we know, if you need a reminder, is the tissue that contains the neurons that are responsible for processing information, memory, emotion, executive function, etc. And so they saw significant reductions in grey matter. And interestingly, it did have an effect for people who had HRT, but maybe not quite the same level. Right. So that does a little bit offset it, but not completely. And the people with the HRT, they did slightly better in cognitive tests from reaction times perspective, but it also was directly correlated with the loss of grey matter with the increase in anxiety and depression and sleep disturbances for women who've had the reduction in the grey matter, but then they had these other symptoms as well connected to it. So it's fascinating because we're learning more and more each month when we're looking at sort of the brain and scans, and the biobank, of course, being a credible source of information for things like this.
Absolutely. So when you talk about cognitive decline, because this isn't something that, I guess, you know, we don't tend to talk, we talk about brain fog or whatever. This is a permanent decline as a result of menopause?
So I think the difference between this change in cognitive function and grey matter, everyone loses grey matter over time. Mm. It's just it happens very quickly. So with men, it happens, but slowly but surely it happens as you get older. But with menopause, it's a very sharp drop.
Right.
And so that's one of the big things, is there's a lot of symptoms that isn't just getting older. It happens very abruptly and very quickly. And that can obviously can affect, you know, people as they go about their day, and they're forgetting things, or their emotionals, you know, regulation is not what it used to be. Mm. And so it can be a big adjustment. And what I like about this is the fact that even it gives a reason sometimes for people to say, okay, that makes a lot of sense. You know, this is something that's physically happening within my body. Yeah. It's not just in my head. And I think with, you know, menopause or anyone who's going through, you know, changes abruptly like this, whatever your stage of life, the fact that there might be a reason behind it, you know, biochemically or chemically, physiologically, it can be a big thing. That can help. You know?
Absolutely. And then, you know, I always have a conversation with our teenagers about hormones and how, you know, how it's not your fault if you're a particular way this morning. Shane, our final story has to do with T. gondii, this absolutely fascinating parasite that just keeps on giving.
Yeah, 1/3 of the world's population have this infection or this parasite that's living within us, Toxoplasma gondii, and it lives in and exists as cysts, typically in neurons, so in the brain or in the skeletal system. And for most of us, it'll just be completely dormant, and it'll exist because of the way it's constructed in the body. It's virtually impenetrable. It's bulletproof. Like, nothing can get rid of it. And unfortunately, it can switch on. So it can go from its dormant state to its active state, particularly for people who may be immunocompromised, or if you are pregnant and this happens, there can be severe complications. As I say, it affects 1/3 of the world's population. It comes just because of being in contact with fecal matter or eating raw meat. It's not something that anyone listening could actively try to avoid.
No.
It's just there. So obviously, given how much it can affect people's brains, it can affect their eyesight. A lot of people are concerned about ways to treat it. Now, I should stress, this is not something that everyone gets. It's very, very rare. So just because 1/3 of the people have it doesn't mean that 1/3 of the people should expect to ever have complications from it. Nonetheless, those that do...
Reminds me of HPV and cervical cancer, you know, that a lot of, almost everybody gets HPV, not everyone gets cervical cancer.
Exactly, yeah. So... It, as I say, for most people, it's inside and it's dormant. And we thought that basically that what was in there was just the same thing. It was uniform in everyone. And what this study has shown is that there's a huge amount more going on. As always with biological studies, complexity is always the outcome, which is great. And the kind of the meat and bones of this study is that now that we know about the makeup, the complex makeup of what's going on and how we move from a dormant to an active state, we now have an awful lot more information that we might be able to use to tackle what's going on in other words, to develop treatments that would respond to it and maybe even eradicate it from within the human.
Yeah, so the T. gondii is really interesting as a parasite. And if you've heard it before, it's probably because of its unusual effect that it seems to have on rodents, where its life cycle is through the gut of a cat. And so if you're a cat... you're basically host of this parasite and you allow for the whole transmission of it. But if a mouse gets this parasite, they become sort of immune to cat wee and go towards a cat instead of away from a cat and end up getting eaten by the cat. And that's how the parasite goes through the cat's gut. It's an absolutely fascinating life cycle.
A study with mouse models, which is very common, but was no mouse or cat models were used in this one. So interesting.
Bit of a cat mask. But what was really interesting is that this sort of question of whether or not the parasite made mice a little more impulsive and a little less scared. The question is whether or not people who were infected by this parasite also became a little bit more risk-taking. And there were some studies to suggest that perhaps you might drive a little faster if you're infected with this parasite and so on.
Really?
Yeah, but I am not entirely sure. I think there needs to be a real solid yes, absolutely. But
we
this is the question.
Ban all those people from having driving licenses. That would be a great idea.
Or maybe just slow down their cars.
No, let's ban them.
Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Susan Kelleher, thank you so much for joining us. All right, on the way, how scientists are growing a replica womb lining in the lab and what it means for IVF. Stay with us. Yes, this is our weekly science program here on the station. I'm Jonathan McRae. It's called Future Proof. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. Now, most of us think that the big mysteries of pregnancy happen months down the line. And we think of those milestones, those scans, figuring things out. But actually, most of the really decisive things happen very, very early on in a window of human development that's almost never seen, even by scientists. Our next guest is Dr. Peter Rugg-Gunn from the Babraham Institute at the University of Cambridge, whose team have worked on building a replica womb lining in the lab. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Peter. Talk to me a little bit about this work that you've done Let's first off talk about why understanding what happens in the womb lining is so important.
That's right. As you mentioned in your introduction, we're interested in better understanding the very early events in how we develop, how humans develop. And about 7 days after the egg is fertilized, the embryo has developed into this microscopic ball of cells. It's about the same width as a human hair, for example, so you need a microscope to be able to see it. And at this point in development, the embryo would attach to the lining of the womb, which is a tissue called the endometrium. And this is a crucial event, as it really marks the establishment of hopefully a healthy pregnancy. And so once the embryo has attached to the womb lining, it undergoes this process of invasion and implantation, where it becomes embedded into this endometrial tissue. And these events are critical for, as you say, sort of really the long-term health of this pregnancy. But because these events are normally hidden from view and we lack the sort of experimental models in the laboratory, these early events are really unknown to science, and they very rarely have been looked at. And so we've really sort of lacked an understanding of how these early events actually happen in human development.
And this is a process by which half of all pregnancies fail, right?
Well, that's right. It's remarkable. You might think that the embryo implants really efficiently, but actually in humans it seems to not do that. It seems to probably only implant in about half of all pregnancies, and so it's really seems to be quite a failure point in terms of establishing a pregnancy. And of course this can be really distressing in situations such as if somebody's been undergoing IVF, for example, and then the embryo fails to implant once it's transferred. And so really sort of knowing more about how embryos normally undergo this implantation process, we hope can be very helpful to improving the efficiency of some of these fertility treatments.
Before we go any further, I just want to ask a question. It's probably not your area of expertise, but I'm just wondering, do we understand why we have developed such a such a difficult path to pregnancy? Why do we have just one egg, landing in this lining of the womb, and hopefully then succeeding, failing 50%? Like in terms of evolution, this lots of other animals just throw a million different options down the line. Why considering how early on it is? Why do we only typically have one egg in the womb lining as opposed to having that process jigged around a different way, that there are more options for success and a more successful birth?
Yeah, it is an interesting question, isn't it? I think a likely or one possible explanation is that the person carrying the pregnancy has to. It's probably all about balance of resources. Mm. So there has to be a very good chance for that pregnancy to continue for the full 9 months. And so there seems to be quite a lot of sort of almost quality control steps early on here. So that only, when the embryo and the endometrium are both happy to proceed, then, the pregnancy continues. But given that, it requires quite a lot of kind of investment and resources, in the person carrying the pregnancy, of course.
Mm. And so when you've got such a small number of cells in the lining, as you say, just a very tiny amount of matter of biological tissue, what is happening as far as we know, or what do we imagine is happening in the lining of the womb there?
Yeah, well, we didn't know too much about it, but that's part of the excitement of now in our research, having built a new experimental system in the laboratory where we can, to a certain extent, mimic some of these early events. We can now visualize events that just haven't been seen before. And so one of the things we were most surprised about was that soon after the embryo implants, the cells of the embryo start growing out and they start invading and infiltrating into the endometrial tissue. And this probably serves a couple of purposes. It probably helps to sort of anchor the embryo in place. So it's sort of secure and solid. And it probably also begins this communication with the underlying endometrium. So it's probably a way of meet and greet, so to speak. So the embryo begins to talk to the endometrium, and the endometrium begins to talk to the embryo. And these are some of the early events that we've been able to look at.
And how exactly do you go about building a womb lining in a lab? Presumably, you can't just construct that from scratch.
We start with the components. So what we do is we obtain some small biopsies of endometrial tissue that have been donated to our research. And from those biopsies, we can grow out two different types of cell that are normally found in the endometrium. So one type of cell is called a stromal cell. And these, what we do is we take these stromal cells and we sort of embed them in a gel, basically, just to hold them in place. Mm. And these stromal cells are really important because they secrete lots of sort of factors that are required in order to help nurture the embryo, basically.
Right.
And then on top of this stromal cell gel mix, we layer on another type of cell that we obtain from the biopsies, and these are called epithelial cells, and these are the cells that the embryo first attaches to when it meets the endometrium. And so we were able to generate a system where we've got this kind of multi-layer, if you can imagine that, within this petri dish. And those different layers mimic more or less the same layers that are typically found inside endometrial tissue.
Right. And so where do you get the eggs to implant to watch this happen?
We collaborate with several IVF clinics in the southeast of England. And we receive embryos that are donated to our research program from individuals who have typically completed an IVF procedure, for example.
So right.
What typically happens in IVF is during the course of the treatment, they make several embryos and they take the best quality embryos
to make
the baby, basically. And then hopefully the individual then goes on to have a healthy pregnancy, healthy baby. And then the individual or the couple are then asked what they would like to be done to their remaining embryos that are now frozen in storage at their clinic.
Yeah.
And they can choose either for the embryos to be destroyed, or they can choose to essentially store them forever. Although they can choose to donate them to either training or to research or to other individuals also going through IVF. And so many couples, in fact most individuals who are asked this question, they actually choose to donate their embryos, and most of them choose to donate to research where their clinic offers that choice. I think they recognize that the treatment that they've received, that's hopefully been successful for them, has been built on many years of research that
for
came
sure.
before
yeah.
that. And so it's their way of contributing to that research process in the hope that future individuals will benefit from, you know, improvements to efficiencies yeah. of IVF and things like this.
That's wonderful. So when you get these embryos, you implant them in this artificial womb, what are you seeing that you weren't able to see before, and how long can you observe something like that and feel that what you're seeing is a good analog for what's happening inside the mother's body?
That's right. So what we can do is we typically receive the embryos at the equivalent of day 5. So that's 5 days after the egg has been fertilized in the fertility clinic.
Mm.
And under UK law, we can grow those embryos up to the 14th day in the laboratory. So we have a 9-day window in which we can implant the embryo in the laboratory in this new model and observe the embryo as it develops. And then we have to stop the experiment on the 14th day. And one of the really amazing things that we saw actually was in this new system that we built, we could see the early building blocks of the placenta. So this was really the very first types of cells that are formed by the embryo that will later become the placenta, much later in development. But this was the first time that these events in how the very building blocks of the placenta are first formed and how they begin to organize themselves. And so this was a really important thing to be able to look at, because it's thought that many of the sort of quite common but very serious conditions, such as preeclampsia or growth restriction, that are picked up typically later in pregnancy, it's thought that actually they may have their origins very early on in pregnancy, probably at the sort of timing, the time that we're now looking at, the very early building blocks of the placenta. And so if we can sort of try to use our model to better understand how the early placenta is formed, it may give us some clues as to why some pregnancies then develop conditions such as preeclampsia later on.
How much confidence do you have in obviously, you know, when you're talking about two layers of two types of cells and embryo, you don't, it's not a full copy of what's obviously happening inside a woman's body. There's so many different molecules and hormones and other things going on. When you use a model like this, how useful is it? Or is there a risk that you're not getting enough of a 3D environment to properly to understand what's going on? I guess what I'm saying is, as a model, it's obviously the best we can do right now. It's cutting edge for this moment, but it still misses the entire environment of a woman's womb. And I'm just wondering how much can you take from that, or how much do you have to say, well, this may not behave exactly the same way if it was in utero.
Exactly. That's a question we ask ourselves a lot in our research. So we do have some clues as to what an embryo should look like soon after it's implanted. There's sort of old data going back many, many decades that have given us sort of static snapshots of what an implanted embryo should look like. So we could kind of match out what we were seeing in our system down the microscope compared to these previous sort of specimens, and we could sort of actually they compare really quite favorably to those static snapshots.
Okay.
And so we were sort of quite excited by that. It sort of told us, actually, you know, this model is replicating some aspects of embryo implantation, and it's sort of on the right lines and is telling us useful things. But you're quite right in that models can always be improved. And so there's several ways in which our model could be improved, such as by adding other cell types that's normally found in the endometrium that we haven't yet added, for example. So you could sort of build, you know, more complexity into the system.
And then finally, I guess I wanted to ask, when it comes to, you know, the potential for research to improve IVF, have you seen anything yet that's exciting that you think, oh my God, this is a problem, or this is potential to solve a massive problem when it comes to IVF and implantation in a commercial setting?
I think we're beginning to see glimpses of that, and that's partly what's so exciting about this. So, for example, in our work, I mentioned one of the benefits is that we can now listen into the communication that's first established between the embryo and the endometrium. And through that, we can sort of work out which pathways seem to be really important for that communication to happen. And the sort of idea behind that is maybe in some cases where embryo implantation doesn't happen as it should, maybe some of these communication pathways are going awry. And so if we could figure out what these pathways are, we can look at them more closely. Perhaps we could better predict which which embryos will implant better. Maybe if there's missing signals, for example, maybe those missing signals could be introduced, for example, into some systems, all of which hopefully one day might lead to, as you say, better implantation rates, better successes of IVF, and maybe a better understanding of, as I mentioned, those pregnancy complications that come later in pregnancy.
Dr. Peter Rugg-Gunn from the University of Cambridge, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
If you're a regular listener to this program, you might have heard the story of Gary and Lisa. Speaking of Peter kind of reminded me of this thing that happened on this program where we reached out to listeners of the show and we met Gary and Lisa, who were young, newlyweds, or they've been married for a year. They've known each other forever. They wanted to have kids and they just couldn't manage to do it. And we introduced them to a fertility doctor that we knew, and over the course of a year, they came on the program regularly talking about this incredible thing that's extremely distressing. And Lisa was like, I don't want to talk to you. Go away. Leave me alone. And then a little bit of hope and then kicked back again in rejection. And it was just an incredible story that ended up in the birth of a child, Nicholas. And that then led to two more children. And it was just such an incredible thing to have happened on a radio program. But it really reminded me that, you know, while we're talking about, you know, working on Petri dishes, that actually at the end of a lot of this research is someone who is really trying to find hope or happiness or something. So, you know, just it's kind of when you talk about stuff in the lab, understanding that actually people who go through IVF often have a really, really tough time. And every once in a while, it works out amazingly well. That is due to science. Just to get to some of your comments from last week, Kimberly Klein, a professor of microbiology and molecular medicine at the University of Geneva, was talking to us about wounds that don't heal, in particular ulcers that develop as a part of diabetes. And it's a horrific condition, affects a huge number of people who suffer from diabetes, and a big problem. Lucy says, I thought your guest on non-healing wounds was great. Really enjoyed the conversation. What does she define as a non-healing or chronic wound? Like, what if it's delayed healing versus fundamentally impaired healing? Well, I think for some people, Lucy, because of the nature of these diabetic ulcers, it's not like most wounds, you know, if treated, will scab over or will knit back together pretty quickly. A matter of days or hours sometimes. But a chronic wound like this is constantly open, constantly sore, constantly causing pain, and they're really, really painful. So I think that was the definition that Kimberly gave us on the day. Daniel says, is it possible to replicate real world chronic wounds in a clinical setting? I think that's probably beyond what's possible right now because of the skin, even just skin is difficult to recreate from a structural point of view in a lab. We can create sort of clumps of cells. So we've talked before about organoids like mini brains, but they're really just lumps of cells stuck together and not very well structured. The amazing thing about skin is that there are many layers and they are knitted together with collagen and lots of other processes to form what feels to us like a cohesive surface, but actually recreating that from scratch is a very difficult thing to do. So it's not possible to recreate in a lab, as far as I'm aware, Daniel. I haven't heard anything like that just yet. And so the only way you could do it is with synthetic materials, which they do, but it's not, you're not going to get the whole chemical and signaling of cells with synthetic wounds, or and I would imagine this is unethical, actually using animal models. So I guess no is the answer right now. I'm guessing, but it's a well-informed guess, I would say. And then we had Luigi Occhipinti, who's a research professor of smart electronics, biosystems and AI at Cambridge University. He was talking about Revoice, this incredible AI-powered device that allows people to speak because the AI can sort of guess what they're saying by listening to tremors in their throat and their heart. Really incredible stuff. And actually 95% correct and high satisfaction rates. That's really hard to do with technology. So they're doing really well. Someone says, how does Revoice compare with current assistive communication systems, e.g. eye tracking, brain computer interfaces in terms of usability and speed? Well, number one, brain computer interfaces, as we know, are hugely invasive still. You still need to connect a wire to someone's brain, or you need to have literally open a part of the skull to be able to use a BCI. You know, doing something over the skull isn't very effective still. You've probably seen in some of the science museums people trying to focus, and you've probably seen those sort of games. It's very difficult to get good quality, clean signal from the noise using something over the skull. So BCIs are really just out when it comes to this. And eye tracking does require to have a device on you. I think there are some glasses that do it. But my guess is that this is someone doing something that's natural to them. They're speaking and that speech is getting instantly without a delay translated into a voice that's 95% close to what they were going to say. And that to me would be the best solution if they got that percentage up to being 99, 98%, where if you spoke with your voice as you used to do before you had a stroke, it sounds perfect. I mean, that seems like the Holy Grail, right? And Rosie says, I'm intrigued about the power or battery life and computational restraints are involved in wearing a wearable device intended for continuous use. Well, so Rosie, with this particular device, you're not talking about an enormous, you're talking about sensors, very low power, right? And then you're talking about some way of communicating to a mobile phone, low energy Bluetooth. I mean, I would say these devices are going to last at least as long as your mobile phone battery, and then you recharge your phone. Like there's no heavy wear in the sort of work. The AI presumably is done on device, edge, or in the cloud. So the great thing about this solution is it'll work all the time. These are all very, very big guesses, but I think that's right. Thank you for all of your comments, and thank you for your questions. I hope you enjoyed the pod. Thanks to Marais O'Sullivan, who's producing, Hugh Keenan on podcasts, and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.